This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio. This is your host, David Swanson. Our guest for the next hour will be Dean Baker. We are very privileged to have Dean as a guest. He is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He previously worked as a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute and an assistant professor at Bucknell University. His blog, Beat the Press, with a B, Beat the Press, features commentary on economic reporting. He received his PhD in economics from the University of Michigan. He is an author of numerous books and reports, an award-winning author. You can check out his bibliography on the website, thepeoplespeakradio.net. You can also go to thepeoplespeakradio.net right now and go into the chat room and ask questions of Dean Baker as we go along, and I will ask them for you. Or better yet, you can call in and ask them yourself just the way you want to, toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Anywhere else in the world, toll-free, 877-489-6350. 877-489-6350. Dean Baker, welcome to the People Speak Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
It's terrific to have you, especially since one of the biggest stories in the news the past several weeks has been something that many people like myself, who consider ourselves at least generally intelligent, find incredibly confusing. You tell me if this is not a good place to start, but I'd like to start with this so-called bailout that began this rash of financial stories in the top of the news. Was it a good thing? Did it have to be done immediately or the sky would fall? Or was it, in fact, a counterproductive, damaging thing to do?
Well, we needed something to be done. It didn't have to be done immediately. There was a very severe problem with the banking system. And what we did, basically, was give a lot of money to the richest people in the country. The president made this big push. It was the first time in my lifetime I've ever heard a president compare his own policies to the Great Depression. Usually your political opponents do that, but he did that himself. And, he said, well, we're going to be facing the Great Depression if we don't pass this bailout bill right away. And then the ironic thing about it was when they did finally get it passed, Henry Paulson, his Treasury Secretary, sat around for 10 days, did absolutely nothing after telling us, how desperate it was. Now, the bottom line was many of the banks were in really bad shape. The banking system, the financial system was breaking down. They didn't trust each other. They would not lend each other money. There were real serious problems there. There were ways around them. One of them, the Federal Reserve Board Chair Ben Bernanke announced the week after the bailout passed that he would start to lend money directly to non-financial corporations. There's this big commercial paper market. That's how most major companies, a Boeing or a United, whoever it might be, how they finance their operations. They issue short-term commercial paper, which is usually bought up by the banks. They were having trouble selling that. Well, Bernanke, the Fed chair, said, well, I can get around that. I could just buy it up directly. Well, he announced that the week after the bailout. He could announce that the week before the bailout. They were playing a lot of games here, and the long and short, the reason why people should be really, really angry is that while we have a public interest in keeping the financial system going, we all are going to be harmed if our financial system just collapsed. We have zero public interest in handing taxpayer dollars to absolutely the richest people in the country. So we're taxing Joe the plumber, we all know is kind of a largely fictitious entity, but the point is we're taxing middle-income people to hand to the richest people in the country, the Wall Street bankers, and we're giving it to them because they messed up on their job. And that's a really hard thing to tell people. It's a really hard thing to justify. And we could have put conditions on so that wouldn't have happened. We could have said, if we're going to put equity in your company as we did in your bank, that, A, you don't pay dividends like, they did in Britain, And B, the executives take pay cuts. And they didn't do that. They played games with us. You know, it was actually, I found that the most offensive thing of all, probably, that you had members of Congress get up there and say, oh, these executives won't get their big salaries. Now, that was garbage. And they know it was garbage. They're not that stupid. I've seen them walk and chew gum at the same time. They're not that stupid. So, you know, basically they took taxpayer dollars and gave it to the absolute richest people in the country, and they justified that by saying we have to do this to save the banking system, and people should be really upset.
So, I mean, it was a very interesting situation where we had the public clearly, wildly, and in a sort of cross-partisan way against this thing. And you had the presidential candidates of both parties and leaders of both parties pushing for it. And as you say, it looks like there were members of Congress who lied to us about it. There also may have been members of Congress who should feel like the administration lied to them. I mean, we had Brad Sherman stand up and say that Congress members were told there would be martial law if we didn't pass this immediately. There was a great hurry, and we had to do it, or the sky would fall. How... Assuming there are Congress members really in that position, should they feel like absolute fools now? Should they feel like they were betrayed? Is there anything they can do to take it back? What's your view on
that? Well, they could try to pass new conditions. I mean, obviously they can't do that when they're not in session, but they could try to put conditions on the bailout. They can do that. I mean, I don't know that the leadership would go along. President Bush would probably veto it during his term in office, the remaining months in his term in office, but... You know, to my mind, by all means, that'd be worth trying, you know, to say, how about saying we put the same conditions on that the United Kingdom put on? I mean, one of the other things, you know, that I and others said, you know, Warren Buffett invested $5 billion with Goldman Sachs. Why didn't we get the same deal Warren Buffett did? I mean, you know, they give it to Warren Buffett. Why wouldn't they give it to the federal government? I don't quite understand, you know, so... You know, here you get Henry Paulson, who's, you know, a shrewd business guy. You know, he was running Goldman Sachs before he came to bail them out. And suddenly, you know, we have all separate, whole different way of, you know, doing things. You know, it's, he didn't apply good business principles. If he applied the same business principles, I'm sure he wouldn't have been running Goldman Sachs. So I just don't understand. It's like we're here to be taken advantage of. Well, it's just not funny. You know, and these people can be really tough. Let's go back a decade when it was welfare reform was the item on the agenda.
Right.
Well, there they wanted to be real tough, and they knew how to be tough. They made it really hard to get, you know, TANF. You know, they made people jump through lots of hoops. And, you know, at the end of the day, even when you get TANF, you're only talking about, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a year. Here they just handed out $150 billion, kind of no questions asked. They know how to be tough when they want. They just decided not to be tough here.
What's the relationship between monkey business on Wall Street and the real economy, including the housing market here? And what, you know, I used to work for years for an organization called Acorn that has been blamed absurdly, I think, for this, among other outrageous crimes.
Yeah, you guys brought down the economy. I know about Acorn.
And, I mean, immigrants have been blamed for this. All sorts of groups have been blamed for what looks like crimes and abuses on Wall Street. How do we make sense of these charges?
Well, I mean, it's remarkable. Well, you make sense of them by saying that, obviously, you have a lot of people that got caught. You know, they got caught with their fingers, their hands in the cookie jar, their whole bodies in the cookie jar. And, you know, obviously they don't want to, they're out there making up stories. And, you know, it's one thing, I mean, you understand, you know, just like a little kid, you know, oh, I didn't really take the cookie, it was my brother or my friend, you know, whatever. But what's really upsetting is that these are given any credence. You know, John McCain gets up there and during the debate, he goes, oh, it was Fannie and Freddie, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that caused this. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac acted horribly, and I've trashed them again and again in my writings. But the idea that somehow they caused this, that's close to crazy. I mean, the biggest crime that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac did was they joined in the party, but the party was going on. This was Wall Street greed through and through, and it's just a fabrication. That say, I don't think it's too far to say, it really appeals to kind of a crude racism that, you know, you could somehow blame this on minorities. And you go to Acorn, you know, these community groups that were trying to, you know, ensure that people had a chance to get a home or weren't being redlined, and to say that somehow... I mean, you know, you just think about this. You just go, you had bankers that were making tens of millions, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars, and we think that they were doing that because government bureaucrats were forcing them? I mean, it's close to, like, lunacy. If someone really believes that, they should probably be institutionalized. That's so crazy.
yeah. I mean, when I worked at Acorn, we spent more time on than on anything else on trying to keep bad loans out of neighborhoods. You know, much less time was spent trying to get good loans into neighborhoods. But so it strikes me as almost upside down. But there is some connection here to the troubles and the bubbles in the housing market that you've been warning about for a long, long time. Is there not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this nuttiness kept it going. So, you know, I first began warning about the bubble in 2002. And, you know, people would ask me, you know, I learned from the stock bubble because, you know, the stock bubble, I first began writing about in 97. And people would say, when do you think it's going to burst? I go, well, probably in about 6 months. And for 3 years, I looked pretty stupid. But, you know, it did, of course, finally burst, but much later than I would have expected. Well, with the housing bubble, I wouldn't tell anyone when I thought it would burst, but I would have said about 6 months. I mean, you know, if you got me in a room alone. But you know, the basic story is what kept it going. There was already a bubble, as I say, in 02. You could see it there. The evidence is pretty clear, but it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And what kept it going was these ridiculous loans that were coming from Wall Street. There was just an endless pool of money where they would, you know, what was going on was you had the people pushing the loans not just in low-income areas, but, I mean, those areas were hit hardest, but pushing loans they knew wouldn't be paid off, or at least they didn't really care, I'll put it that way, whether they knew that or not, who knows, but they didn't care whether they'd be paid off. But that was fine with them because they could sell it into the secondary market. They could sell it to Citigroup. They could sell it to Merrill Lynch, who would then package it into a mortgage-backed security and oftentimes into more complex instruments and then sell it all over the world. So you had this whole chain of money-making that was based on garbage that, you know, inevitably was going to go bad. You know, we didn't know when, but it was going to go bad. But that was the tie of Wall Street, that if you didn't have the Wall Street guys there to buy up the garbage, you wouldn't have had the mortgage brokers out in the neighborhoods pushing it, because obviously you don't make money by selling loans that people can't pay off.
Well, normally you don't, of course, but when I worked with Acorn, we ran into all sorts of predatory lenders that clearly intentionally made loans where the borrower was supposed to believe they could pay it back, but where the fine print intentionally made that very, very difficult, and where the lender's aim was clearly to force them into refinancing again for more fees, and refinancing yet again for more fees, and in some cases, seizing the house. So there are these upside-down lenders out there who seem to intentionally aim for the borrower not to pay the loan back.
Sure, classic predatory lending, absolutely. You do have that where you look to make enough money in fees and, you know, other charges that by the time, you know, the person may not pay back the loan, but you don't care because you made enough on the fees. That's true. But, you know, when you talk about conventional mortgage, you know, typically you don't want to give a mortgage that people can't pay back.
Yeah, they want it paid back. That's the kind of lenders we were trying to get into Acorn neighborhoods. I have a lot more questions on this, but we're starting to get questions in our chat room at thepeoplespeakradio.net. So I wanna bring some of those in on this conversation. And let me remind listeners, if you have questions for Dean Baker, for the next hour, you can call in toll free 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. Or outside the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350, 877-489-6350. You can also go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and put your questions in the chat room, as these listeners have done. Rob in Canada asks for Dean Baker, could you explain Paulson's, this is Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's, involvement in deregulation legislation that led to this mess?
Yeah, prior to coming to the Treasury, Secretary Paulson had been the chair of Goldman Sachs, who's, of course, the largest of the investment banks. And in that role, he lobbied to have restrictions on leverage, you know, the extent to which the investment banks could borrow relative to their capital. He lobbied to have those restrictions removed, and he succeeded. So he got those restrictions removed, I believe it was in 2002. And after that date, all the investment banks, particularly the two that no longer exist, that went under, Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, became extremely heavily leveraged, in their case, over 30-1. It's desirable to be leveraged because you make more money. You know, it's like if I was going to, you know, go bet on horses and I got someone to lend me $100 for every dollar I bet. Well, if I win, you know, of course, I do much better with their $100 than just my $1. you know, and that's the principle of leverage. You're borrowing money and you make money on the money you borrow. Now, the downside, of course, is there's much greater risk. So if you're leveraged at the rate of 30 to 1, your capital is just 3%, a hair over 3% of the loans you have outstanding, which means, you know, it's sort of a simple rule. If the capital is just 3% of the loans you have outstanding, 3% of your loans go bad, then you're broke. And that's essentially what happened with Goldman Sachs. That's essentially what happened with Lehman Brothers. And it's entirely possible, I'm sorry, Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, it's entirely possible would have also happened with Goldman Sachs and the other two, Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley, if the government had stepped in and come to their rescue.
It sounds reminiscent of 1929.
Well, it's the same sort of thing. I mean, that's, you know, you get these speculative frenzies, and, you know, you had that in the 20s, and you had that in this decade. You had to a lesser extent in the 1990s with the stock bubble. It didn't quite get as bad, but it was the same sort of story, you know, where you had, you know, internet stocks that were basically worthless in some cases, you know, the companies, that their shares trading for several billion dollars. So the same sort of thing, but stock tends to be less heavily leveraged in large part because of reforms coming out of the Depression. So, you know, one of the things they did back in response to the run-up in the 20s and the ultimate the crash in 29 was they put on margin requirements, which made it more difficult. It's, you know, people could still borrow to get stock, but it's more difficult. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it's difficult to say, you know, buy $100,000 of stock with $10,000 down. That would be a difficult thing to arrange now, whereas back during the Depression it wasn't. And, you know, with housing, you do see that sort of leverage. So with housing, you know, it's, you know, even in good times, you know, before this nuttiness, it was common for people to buy a home with 10 or 20% down. And then with the nuttiness we saw, you know, in 04, 05, 06, at the peak of the bubble, a lot of people were buying homes with nothing down. So, you know, you had extremely heavy leverage at that end, and then, you know, because of Secretary Paulson's efforts and others to get the regulations changed, you had very heavy leverage at the point of the investment banks also, you know, just setting themselves up for a fall.
There's a related question we have in the chat room from Dennis in Orlando. What happened to be classified as a Ponzi scheme?
Well, it has that character. I mean, a bubble, a speculative bubble always has that character. So basically, house prices were going up because someone was willing to pay more. And, you know, that's kind of the logic of a bubble. So typically, you know, we go to buy a home, we're looking and we go, well, how much is this worth to me? You know, it's, you know, well, you look at the size, you compare it to a rental unit, you go, how much is it worth to me? But what happened during the bubble was people were saying, well, you know, this home is $200,000 or $300,000, and maybe that's a lot of money. You know, I could rent a place and, you know, pay much less each month renting than my mortgage. But if I think that it's going to be worth 20% more or 30% more in 3 years down the road, well, then it might still be a very good deal. And that is the character of a Ponzi because, you know, you could do that as long as there's still someone there, you know, to buy the home at a higher price, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road. As soon as you run out of people to do that, though, well, then people start asking a question, how much is this home worth for me? And, you know, because prices have driven up so much, the answer is a lot less than the current market value.
Yeah. Something I think you've been warning us about for quite a while. It seems there are a couple questions that arise. One is, what sort of reforms? There were some reforms in the 30s. What sort of reforms do we need now? And then the other question that maybe we should get to a little bit later is, what ought we to have done instead and be doing now to actually stimulate or benefit the real economy? So to take the first one first, what sort of reforms do you think are needed on Wall Street at this point?
Well, there's two directions. I mean, one of them is just on mortgages, the mortgage instrument. I mean, we were selling a lot of exotic mortgage instruments that obviously the buyers didn't understand. And, you know, it should have, you know, Alan Greenspan, the Fed, I mean, there are other regulatory agencies to blame here as well, but Greenspan, the Fed, or the prime, you know, the most important regulatory agency, they should have stepped in. And they actually have issued guidelines. They just did this year. I mean, it's a classic case of closing the barn door, you know, after the horse has gotten out. They just did issue guidelines, and just kind of common sense guidelines, like, you know, a bank should evaluate a customer's ability to repay the mortgage based on a reset rate, not on a teaser rate. I mean, you know, that should have been kind of 101, but they couldn't, you know, for whatever reason, Alan Greenspan couldn't get himself to issue that. Now, I probably would have wanted the Fed to go a little further with those guidelines, but, you know, that's direction one, tighten up the mortgage issuance, just kind of some common sense things. You know, you don't have to arrest people for issuing mortgages, but, you know, the point should be some clear guidelines about what's acceptable and what isn't. The other part is, you know, restoring, you know, regulating, you know, some of these, you know, basically what the banks, this is often referred as deregulation, it's not, it's one side of regulation, because the banks were operating this whole time with the idea, which was absolutely right as we now see, that the government was going to come in and bail them out. So they get in trouble. They're like little kids, you know. So, you know, Henry Paulson and successor Goldman Sachs are like little kids, except they get paid hundreds of millions of dollars. And they make all these gambles, and they're real risky, and they go, oh, we got it all under control, we got it all under control. But if we don't, the government will come and help us out. They'll come and help us, you know, put everything right. And that's true. That's exactly what happened. They got themselves into really big trouble, and what happened? They went running to Uncle Sam, and Uncle Sam fixed it for them. Now, that's not deregulation. That's one-sided regulation. So they still had the government there to help them out when things went bad. The other side of the regulation is supposed to be things like, well, we want to make sure that what you're doing makes sense. So we don't let you get leveraged at a rate of 30-1. We let you get leveraged at a rate of maybe 10-1, something that's more reasonable that contains your risk. We won't let you issue, credit default swaps, these new instruments that, you know, they're the nominal value of the credit default swaps outstanding before everything started to blow up was over $70 trillion, you know, five times the size of the U.S. economy. Just incredible. People are gambling in it, you know, and it's fine if they want to gamble with it, but they're gambling basically with taxpayers' money. So you have to have some serious regulations on leverage, serious regulations on, you know, new financial instruments like credit default swaps that just came into existence in the mid-90s, late 90s. So you have to have regulation on these instruments. And you have to, you know, there's a few other things you have to do to deal with some of these conflicts of interest, like the bond rating agencies. The Congress was had testimony on that today. Bond rating agencies are paid by the people whose bonds they rate. So what do? They come up with good ratings for them. So there's, you know, a lot of things like that have to be reformed. Some of them are complicated. Some of them are very, very simple, painfully simple. So, you know, we're not going to get it all right tomorrow, but there's some things that, you know, are easy to get right. And, you know, it's just remarkable that, you know, we had the negligence we did over the last decade. I should also point out, by the way, this is a bipartisan story because the deregulation began in the Clinton years, and in particular the issue of credit default swaps. That one was not a Republican story. That was a Democratic story. Robert Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary, and Larry Summers, who succeeded him as Treasury Secretary, both played active roles in preventing any regulation in the credit default swap market.
Did you happen to catch Bill Clinton's explanation of all of this on David Letterman last night?
No, I missed it. I would love to have seen it. What, are you serious? You gave a serious explanation?
I am absolutely serious, and I watched it live, but I'm sure you can pick it up on YouTube. He pretty much blamed it on actions beginning in 2001, of course, and he suggested that we ought to have been investing in green energy jobs, which, of course, he wasn't doing prior to that, to my knowledge, instead of allowing these this leveraging and these derivatives and so forth on Wall Street, and that it was the bad management of the Bush administration at the beginning of the decade that got us into this mess.
Well, there's plenty of bad things. You know, President Bush was there for 8 years, so you can't really excuse him for not having done anything to correct the problems. But on the other hand, this did begin with the Clinton administration, and first off, you know, Alan Greenspan, he, of course, was originally appointed by Ronald Reagan, was reappointed twice by Bill Clinton, and Alan Greenspan thought the housing bubble was real cool. He thought under Clinton the stock bubble was real cool. And one of the reasons why he was so willing to tolerate the housing bubble was the economy was dead in the water after the recession, the collapse of the stock bubble in 2001, 2002, 2003. So he saw the housing bubble as a way to get out of the recession caused by the collapse of the stock bubble. So there's a direct line here, and, you know, I'm not particularly trying to blame Clinton. As I said, you know, President Bush was sitting there for 8 years, but Clinton's administration certainly has its fingerprints all over this one, and for him to try and, you know, just toss it on his successor, that's totally disingenuous.
Yeah, and now that I think about it, that David Letterman show that I saw last night may have been from a few weeks back. I don't know that it was live because it's the way they were talking about the primaries and so on. But that was the explanation he gave. And I saw today Henry Waxman announcing an upcoming hearing with Greenspan as one of the witnesses. Did you see that? And do you expect penetrating questions from any of the committee members on this?
Well, I don't know. You know, you actually might see them really question them. I mean, in years back, they had been incredibly deferential to Greenspan. You know, they treated him as the fountain of wisdom and knowledge, and you know, perhaps somewhat intimidated by him. But I think the world's changed, and you know, it wouldn't surprise me if you might actually see some members of Congress really go at him because you know, I think. They know the public's mad, and I think they'd welcome the opportunity to look to be, you know, the one who's really shaking things up. So you might actually see some serious questions posed that way. I mean, Greenspan, you know, first off, I'll give him credit for being an incredibly good politician. He's very good at kind of covering his rear. That's why he, you know, was so successful for so long. I mean, having been Fed chair under, you know, four different presidents and both Republican and Democratic administrations. But you know, he has a lot to answer for, and you know, I remember him giving a talk at the American Economic Association convention back in 2004, and he was really patting himself on the back for the idea that for just letting the stock bubble grow, and he said, well, that was the right thing to do. You know, we decided that, you know, we have the stock bubble and we could try to contain it, but the best thing to do is just let it grow and then deal with the fallout. Like, that was no big deal. And presumably that's what he thought about the housing bubble too, and you know, it just isn't funny. You know, millions of people are losing their home. We're gonna have a real bad recession. It's just not really very funny. But you know, Greenspan thought that, you know, bubbles are cute, and you know, I really do hope he's called on the carpet for it.
Yeah, that would be nice to see. In terms of reforms on Wall Street, what about proposals that financial transactions be taxed and that Wall Street millionaires pay for their own bailouts rather than us paying for them?
Well, I've worked on financial transactions taxes for, you know, about 15 years now, and I've never heard, to my mind at least, a serious argument against it. That, you know, the idea here is that you just have a small transactions tax. England, they tax every stock trade 0.025%. No doubt about it. No one's ever going to like paying the tax. But the point is, you know, what sort of impact does this have if someone's looking to buy shares of IBM stock or General Electric? They're going to put it aside for 10 years with the idea it'll be there for their retirement or put their kids through college or something. Well, 0.025%, you're really not going to notice it. You know, I know Joe the plumber will jump up and down at the screen, but serious people will just go, yeah, I don't want to pay the tax. But, you know, we pay capital gains tax when we sell the stock, and my guess is most people don't even know what it is. You know, they don't even know what the level is. So, you know, for a little higher, you wouldn't notice it. You wouldn't want to pay it, but, it wouldn't kill you. So if you add a very modest tax, you could raise a huge amount of money. You would also have it on options and futures. So if people are, you know, speculating in jet fuel or, you know, wheat, corn, other commodities, you tax those at about 0.02%. So, again, for the airline, you know, Southwest Air wants to hedge their jet fuel, which, you know, they actually do, they're not even going to notice. You know, they won't be happy about it, but they aren't going to notice. You know, 0.02%, they won't even notice. But if someone's, you know, speculating and borrowing lots of money to buy up, you know, futures and jet fuel with the idea they're going to make a lot of money, well, they're going to pay a lot of money on the tax. And, you know, I just see it as like gambling. You know, you go to Las Vegas, you go and gamble. We don't arrest you, but we're going to tax you. And, you know, it's the same thing. If you want to gamble on the stock market, go ahead and do it, but we're going to tax you. And, again, I was saying with my calculations, you could easily raise on the order of $100 billion a year. That would pay for this bailout. You know, not in 1 year, but certainly in, you know, 3, 4, 5 years would pay for the bailout. And in the process, you'd be getting rid of a lot of this speculation, which serves no economic purpose. You know, it'd be like saying fewer people gamble in Las Vegas. Why would anyone care? Too bad. I mean, obviously, if you're in a Las Vegas casino, you won't be happy, and people on Wall Street won't be happy. But from the standpoint of the economy, it's just not a loss.
Well, now 3 or 4 years of $100 billion, you don't pay for the $700 billion unless we're getting some of that back and we're not ponying up additional hundreds of billions for second and third and fourth bailouts. It sounds
Yeah, well, we'll get some of the $700 billion back. I mean, it's unrealistic to think we're going to lose it all. I mean, particularly, you know, thankfully Henry Paulson changed his original plan. You know, his original plan was he was just going to buy up, you know, these bad assets, buy up all these bad mortgage-backed securities. He instead said we're going to, you know, directly inject equity into the banks. We'll get a share of their, you know, get preferred shares of their stock, and, you know, we'll get something, you know, we'll get a return. We didn't get a real good return. He didn't make a good deal for us, but, you know, we didn't just give it away. So, you know, we will see much of that back. I mean, basically the only way we don't get it back is if banks go under, and, you know, I actually think some of them probably will, but they aren't all going to go under. So, you know, we will get, you know, most of that back is my expectation. Now, that doesn't mean we won't lose $200 billion, but we can make that back.
Yeah. I saw an article you wrote within the past day or two about asking when are we going to see some pay cuts on Wall Street, and I saw another article today unrelated on a report on various wealthy countries and gaps in wealth and income and possible mobility from lower income to upper income, and summary was, you know, if you want the American dream, move to Sweden or Norway. America is becoming more and more divided with less and less possibility of moving up. And yet here we are giving our money to the very wealthiest with, as you indicated, apparently no penalties and no pay cuts.
Yeah, you know, this memo was just a real outrage, and, you know, it's really kind of funny because you raise it in Washington, D.C. circles, and people just think you're being really rude, and you just go, well, didn't Congress promise, you know, that they were going to put an end to these, you know, real high pay packages, and they go, oh, well, that was only, you know, golden parachutes for people who did this, this, and that, you know, basically no one, you know, and,
yep.
And you know, so it's sort of a reasonable thing to say, well, you sold this as a package that was going to contain pay on Wall Street. You didn't sell it as it was going to contain package under, you know, for people with one eye or under 4 feet, 2 inches tall and more than 70. You know, you pretended it was going to have an impact on people on Wall Street. Otherwise, you're wasting our time. So who did it have an impact on? And the answer, no one. No one has taken a pay cut. You know, we've been hearing stories, you know, the CEO of Merrill Lynch, I believe it was, is leaving with a $10 million pay package. You know, most of us won't work for that much in our lifetime. You know, so people have every right to be upset, but, you know, if you raise this, it's like you're being rude. You know, we just handed away all this money to the very richest people in the country, to taxpayers' dollars, and, you know, to ask for any accountability is somehow rude.
Well, I think we're justified in being a little rude in this case. We've got a question in the chat room from Mike in California, who asks what hopes you have for Obama if he becomes president as far as addressing the underlying reasons for the current economic mess. And, of course, the question applies to both of the candidates. Why did they back this thing? It seems clear to me that Obama would have a bigger lead if he hadn't, and McCain might be in the lead if he hadn't, and yet they both did.
Well, you know, both of them are responding obviously to their to political pressures. In the case of McCain, you know, his, you know, certainly, you know, his close ties to Wall Street. He hasn't, you know, however much he might say a few words about populism here and there, it's clear his policies are overwhelmingly oriented towards making the rich richer, and, you know, that's kind of the centerpiece. You know, we're going to maintain tax cuts for rich people. Obama has plenty of ties to Wall Street, too. You know, Robert Rubin was someone he used to cite as a close advisor. He hasn't used that name lately. You know, but he has plenty of close ties to Wall Street, gets lots of money from Wall Street. But the flip side of that is he also has a lot of grassroots support. And, you know, he's a tremendously skilled politician. He's a very cautious politician. He wants to be president. And, you know, I'm sure he thought about this carefully, and he decided that, you know, that the path of least resistance here was, you know, you get out and say, okay, I support the bailout. Because, you know, in just recognizing the reality, the media, they were cheering for the home team here. If you didn't support the bailout, you know, then you're some sort of nutball. You know, you're a knuckle scraper. They get this way on certain issues, and they certainly got it that way on the bailout. And even though, you know, basically everything they said about the bailout, the vast majority of things they said about the bailout, we now know was not true. It was very poorly designed. Just about every economist I know of, you know, thinks is, you know, the original proposal that they're going to buy out the bad assets was really poorly designed. There were no real checks on executive pay. You know, I and others were saying that, and we were being dismissed. Well, guess what? There were no real checks on executive pay. You know, they would not, but the media would not tolerate the opposition. So, you know, Senator Obama's thinking first and foremost he wants to get elected. And, you know, he could have said, no, it's a bad bailout, you know, and tried to make the case. But he would have gotten beaten up on really bad by the media. And I think he decided, you know, there's a month and a half till the election. I don't need that.
Am I sensing any optimism or some would say wishful thinking in there that Obama will be a better president than he's been a senator and a candidate? Or can we expect sort of the same performance as president?
I think you should look to Senator Obama as a very astute politician, a very, very skilled politician, and one who will respond to pressures. And if, you know, if there's an effective grassroots movement to say, you know, we want to reform Wall Street, we want health care reform, you know, we want green economic policies, Senator Obama will respond to that. And he might even jump ahead and lead it. But he's first and foremost, you know, a politician, someone who's, you know, he got to be where he is by being a very effective politician, which means playing it safe. So, you know, if someone thinks he's going to take us to their promised land, no, he's not going to do that. But if the pressure's there, I think he will respond to it.
With that in mind, we are going to have to take a few-minute break, and when we come back, perhaps talk about what we should be doing and perhaps what we should be encouraging President Obama and the 111th Congress to be doing. If you want to get in on this conversation with Dean Baker when we come back from the break, go ahead and call in now in the U.S. and Canada, toll-free 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. Anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350, or go to the chat room at thepeoplespeakradio.net. We will be back in just a few minutes.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world for the broken.
one bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief of that summer people.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio at thepeoplespeakradio.net. This is your host, David Swanson. Our guest for the next 20 minutes is Dean Baker, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research in Washington, D.C., award-winning author and economist, and one of his websites you can find at prospect.org/Dean Baker. His blog is called Beat the Press. If you want to get in on the conversation, call toll-free 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494, or go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and put your questions in the chat room. We were talking, Dean, before we went to break about what perhaps we ought to have been doing or ought to do now to actually benefit a troubled economy, and perhaps what we might hope Congress might attempt to do if it comes back into session this year. What's your thinking?
Yeah, the economy badly needs stimulus. I mean, the basic story here is that because of the crash of the housing bubble, we on the one hand saw a big fall off in housing construction. We already saw that. Housing construction is down on the order of $300 billion a year. And obviously that's a big hit to the economy, but we've largely gotten through that. That's been made up for by improvements on the trade balance for the most part, and to some extent by improvements, increases in non-residential construction. But on top of that, we're going to see a big fall off in consumption. I should say going. We are seeing that now. The basic story here is that people were spending based on the wealth that they had in their homes, or at least thought they had in their homes, you know, as a result of the housing bubble. So, by my calculations, we had the order of $8 trillion in housing bubble wealth. That would come to about $110,000 for every homeowner in the country. And that just disappeared, or at least most of that has disappeared over the last 2 years. And as a result of that, people are cutting back their consumption in a really big way. So you have people canceling their trips, people aren't buying cars, they aren't spending the way they used to in some cases because they literally don't have the money they had been borrowing against their home. They don't have the money to borrow against, they don't have the equity they could borrow against. In other cases, they're simply taking a look and they're going, you know, you have people in their 50s have nothing saved for retirement. They don't have any equity in their home anymore. They realize they have to start saving. And then that's probably a good thing. But from the standpoint of the economy, it means we have this huge shortfall in demand on the order of, you know, probably about $400 billion a year. So what I and a lot of other economists have been arguing is we need a really big stimulus package. We need somewhere in the order of $300 or $400 billion a year in spending for the next 2 years to make up for this lost consumption. And, you know, it's important that Congress act on this quickly because, you know, we're losing jobs. It's just getting worse by the day. You're, you know, one round of layoffs after another. And, of course, what gets announced is a fraction of the jobs that are actually lost. So what we really need is for Congress to come back into session shortly after the election and push through a stimulus, which hopefully will be on things that are actually useful. Last time their stimulus was sending checks to people and, you know, that was better than nothing, but the fact was a lot of that wasn't spent. Most of it wasn't spent. So that meant it didn't have much of an impact. If we're to send checks again today, and my guess is even less would be spent just because people are so scared, which means, you know, it won't have much of an impact on the economy. So what I'd rather see is have the money go to places where it will be spent, will have an immediate impact. You know, some of the ones are obvious. You extend unemployment insurance benefits, that people getting that money will spend it. They need it. You could increase food stamps money that's going to, you know, mostly lower income workers that, you know, again, they'll spend that money, money of state and local governments, you know, that are now making cutbacks. You know, worst thing that could happen, you know, they're laying off people in the middle of recession. We don't want that. So if we can get some money to state and local governments through revenue sharing, they don't have to do that. Then you could do some infrastructure projects. You know, everyone's got schedules for repairing, you know, roads and bridges and other infrastructure. Have them move that forward. Give them the money, have them move it forward. We could also do some green infrastructure. So we could have money for retrofitting buildings to make them more energy efficient, homes, businesses, public buildings. That'd be a very good use of our money, getting their power grid, modernizing the power grid so we don't waste so much electricity transmitting it. These are all things that can be done relatively quickly. And the big, to my mind, the big item that conceivably could be on the agenda is we could do health care. We could extend health care coverage if we gave tax credits to companies to cover workers that aren't currently covered or to improve the coverage for workers that are. This could be a jump start to getting us towards a good national health care program. So we can actually look to this as an opportunity that, you know, on the one hand, we have to spend money. We have to try and boost the economy to get us out of the downturn. On the other hand, it could be a big foot in the door to do some of the big things that really need to be done that have been neglected for a long time.
Just to clarify, as an ideal long-term solution, are you thinking single-payer health coverage, but this as a step in that direction?
Well, I'm a big fan of single-payer, but I think we have a long way to go to get there, you know, so this
sure.
could be a step towards that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It occurs to me that the things you're suggesting are all actually useful things we could spend money on, and there seems to be trillions of dollars out there for things we actually don't want and shouldn't be spending money on, not just this so-called bailout, but the one thing we spend much more than that on, namely the military and wars, not to mention spying on us in violation of our own Bill of Rights and other things that could be cut and that, if up to voters, would be cut. How do we eventually take some of the trillions we're spending on wars and weapons and spying that we don't need and move some of it to these useful projects?
Well, this will be a matter of public pressure. I mean, you know, there was a good vocal anti-war movement before the start of the war. I think it was relatively effective, not effective enough, obviously, since, you know, we had the war. You know, it will take a movement. We will take pressure. You know, hopefully that can be brought to bear. And, you know, if it's if Obama gets in the White House, or for that matter, if McCain gets into the White House, the Vietnam War ended under Nixon and Ford, not great peace Nicks, but it was a response to public pressure against the war. So, you know,
has this war benefited our economy or hurt it?
It's actually been a mixed story in the sense that when we started the war, the economy was in a downturn, and wars will stimulate the economy. I mean, basically, the rule of thumb with stimulus is spending money on anything stimulates the economy. Now, obviously, we could have done better things. You know, if we'd spent the money on healthcare, we'd spent the money on infrastructure and improving energy efficiency, it would have, all those things would have been much better use of the money, you know, from the standpoint of helping the economy. But if the question is just, okay, we're going to spend the money on war, not at all, well, during those years, you know, we're in the recession in 2002, 2003, then it probably did provide some of a boost to the economy. Now, as the economy picked up some more, 2005, 2006, and began to grow at a decent pace and the unemployment rate got down, then it was a drain on the economy. So it's a mixed story, you know, and it's, you know, I think the main way to judge a war, first and foremost, is, you know, what are we fighting for? We're putting people's lives at stake. You know, is that a good cause? But, you know, as a general rule, war is not good economic policy. I think that's a safe bet.
Yeah. We've got a question in the chat room from Miriam in England, and I'm ashamed to say it took someone from outside our own country to ask this sort of question. But she asks, Mr. Baker, what, in your opinion, as an economist, can people do to help the poor of other countries, for example, the people dying in Niger?
That's a real good question. We tend not to pay that much attention to people dying in poor countries. You know, U.S. foreign aid has always been very limited. I don't think we'll ever get large chunks of money going from the U.S. budget to foreign aid. I think in many ways the best things we could do are facilitate technology transfers. You know, so one of the things that trade policy has done in the last 15 years or so has made it more difficult, you know, say for people to get drugs in the developing world by increasing patent protection on prescription drugs. You know, I'd love to see us go the other way and, you know, have no patents on prescription drugs in developing countries. I'd rather see us develop alternative mechanisms for developing drugs for financing research. Patents are a really inefficient way to do it. You know, all drugs, you know, I'm thinking of the United States here, but, you know, it'd be even cheaper in the developing world, but Walmart can profitably sell generic drugs for $4 a prescription. You know, the only reason you have drugs that cost $300, $400, $500, sometimes more, is because drug company has a patent monopoly on it. And if you need that drug for your health, for your life, you're gonna pay it. If there's any way you can, you know, your insurance company or you have the money to do it, you'll pay it. So that's a really inefficient way to finance the development of drug research. So I'd love to see more money go to direct research of prescription drugs and have those drugs available at their cost of production, which would be almost nothing in many cases. Same thing with things like software, you know, making software available for developing countries, you know, and get computers really cheap. There was a program, I think it kind of fell by the wayside, one laptop per child. The goal was to have laptops available at $100 each that, you know, anyone in the poorest village in sub-Saharan Africa might be able to get. You know, not that they'll have the $100, but it's not that big a thing for, you know, an aid agency to come up with a few million dollars to put out tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of laptops. So there are things like that that we could do that, you know, actually involve, in many cases, very, very little money that, in principle, can make a huge difference in the lives of those people and, you know, give them the chance to, you know, basically build up their own economies.
One of, great answer, by the way. I would like to switch back to our country for a second and ask, in the list of things you suggested for economic stimulus, you didn't name one of the things that has come up repeatedly in related proposals, and that is a moratorium on foreclosures and working out people's loans to keep them in their homes. And I watched an interview that Howard Zinn, a noted historian, gave this week where he suggested that we weren't really going to force change through Washington until we had the sort of heightened tensions that you saw in the 30s, and the example he described was that what we ought to see, start seeing, is people refusing to leave their homes and their neighbors surrounding their homes and refusing to allow their furniture to be taken out and so on. What's your thought on that, this sort of direct action and on legislative action to keep people in their homes?
Well, you know, where people can organize, I'm in favor of people doing things they can that will make a difference. And, you know, where people can organize and, you know, really change the terms, then, you know, that's great. I'm not confident they'll help in a lot of places, but where it does, you know, basically the other side is willing to lie, cheat, and steal. So, you know, if we get a group of people that have a protest, so it's not easy to foreclose, I'm not going to cry about that one. But, you know, I obviously I'm sitting here in Washington, so I'm thinking of legislative things. And, you know, one of the things to keep in mind, not everything happens in Washington. So foreclosure laws can be set at the state level. One of the things I worked on was I called right to rent, that people would, facing foreclosure, have the option to stay in their home as renters. And you could actually write that into foreclosure law. So, you know, it's a step in the process. The foreclosure doesn't mean you're thrown out on the street. It means that if you want, at least, you have the right to rent your home at the market rent, you know, and that can be easily done. You know, we do appraisals of home when people buy them. You could have an appraiser determine the market rent for a house. They just look at comparable units. It's a simple enough thing to do. And then at least people would have security in their homes. They wouldn't just be thrown on the street. But the other part of the story is that if the banks know that the foreclosure process doesn't mean they just get to own the house free and clear and do whatever they want with it, but it means they become landlords, you have much more incentive to try and work out a deal that allows the person to stay in the home as a homeowner. So it's something very simple. Congress obviously could do it. There's actually a bill that didn't get very far, but Representative Raul Grijalva from Tucson proposed it that would allow for this. But it can be done at the state level, and I know there are states that are looking at this. In fact, the candidate for governor in Delaware actually supports this. So, you know, that's something that can be done at the state level, and you know, I hope some states will look into that.
It's a great idea. It's encouraging. Here's a question from Joe. I don't know if he's a plumber, but Joe in Idaho, who asks, Mr. Baker's opinions on microeconomics as successfully employed by Nobel laureate Dr. Muhammad Yunus, could it work in the USA? And I assume he means microloans.
Microloans. You know, I have to say, I haven't studied that as closely as I would like, so I don't feel that I can make that much of an assessment. I think there certainly are success stories, but I've also heard examples of failures. So I think, you know, the idea of trying to open doors for people so that they could be entrepreneurial and, you know, start up small businesses, I think in general that's a good thing. What I'm not convinced of, that's going to be a panacea. So, you know, I think in general it's a good thing that people have access to capital and can start businesses where they, you know, have things they want to do, ideas. But, you know, I'm not sure it's going to be a panacea. And it can be a bad thing. I'll just give you a very concrete example. You know, we can't really argue by anecdotes, but I think a lot of people in this boat, there was a woman in my neighborhood who's opened up a restaurant, and it was just the wrong restaurant at the wrong time at the wrong place. And, you know, I was in my neighborhood. I liked her. I used to go there a lot. But she had a very bad business. And, you know, you just go, well, I don't know what else she might have been doing during those years, but she devoted her savings and worked real long and hard hours. But at the end of the day, the restaurant failed. And, you know, people, not everyone's cut out to be a business person, or people do make mistakes. So I don't know that we want to say, okay, you know, everyone should go into business and that's how you're going to, you know, get ahead, because for a lot of people that simply won't be true. So I think it's a good idea to make sure that people have those opportunities, but I wouldn't expect that that's going to be the path to, you know, everyone getting a secure existence.
Yeah. We have not got too many minutes left, and I want to ask a broader question. You're in Washington. You know how our government is supposed to work, and the Constitution that originally set out how it was supposed to work. And one of the concerns that I and some people have had over this whole bailout proposal and empowerment of the Treasury Secretary is that under our original system of government, Congress was really supposed to handle raising and spending of every dime, and here we've handed an absolute fortune, you know, the size of a national budget, over to a servant of the president to spend as he or she sees fit, and you've suggested that the way he's actually done it is a little bit better than his original proposal, but my concern is the precedent of giving him the power to decide how to do it. Am I right to be worried at all about this?
Absolutely. I mean, his original request was basically a blank check. It was just a 3-page document, and most of it, or I shouldn't say most of it, but a very large share of it was devoted to saying that there's no oversight, no court review. I mean, it's really extraordinary. And Congress did put in some oversight, more kind of after the fact, that, you know, Secretary Paulson does the X, Y, and Z, and Congress has the opportunity to review it, but X, Y, and Z has already been done. So it was really extraordinary, transfer of power from the legislative branch to the executive branch. And again, it was one of the things that, you know, I and many others were worried about, saying, okay, we have to do the bailout. We realize time's important, but, you know, why can't you put in wording that puts in real congressional oversight? You know, you have a 3-person committee. You know, we don't need everyone in the world, but, you know, Congress gets to pick 3 people that, you know, they're going to, Paulson wants to do X, Y, and Z, he's going to show it to them first. You know, that doesn't seem too crazy. But, you know, Bush, I guess, said he wouldn't go for it. I obviously wasn't a party to the negotiations, but, you know, Bush said he wouldn't go for it, or they didn't press it, but they ended up giving a bill that didn't have that. And, you know, what I was saying to these people when they're saying, oh, we can never get him to sign it, you go, well, if we're really worried that this is going to be the Great Depression, I can't believe that he won't sign this. You know, it was inconsistent. You know, if we really believed that we're going off this cliff, the president's really going to refuse to go along with something that just has normal oversight with everything else that gets spent?
Well, Congress fell for another bluff, or pretended to, and was complicit in deceiving and robbing us. But what else is new? Dean Baker, we are out of time. I want to thank you very, very much for being on this program. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Check it out. They do terrific work. He has a blog at prospect.org/Dean Baker, and we very much appreciate your time on the People Speak Radio Network.
Thanks a lot for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Our pleasure. And next Monday, our guest on the People Speak Radio will be Philip Shennan, who is the author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. And my guest next Wednesday will be Charlotte Dennett, candidate for Attorney General of Vermont, who, among other things, has committed to prosecuting George W. Bush for murder should she be elected next month. The People Speak Radio Network is a place where you could wisely put billions of dollars, but even a few pennies would be very, very helpful. We are going to be cutting back drastically on programs for lack of funds that are going to billionaire bankers. Please, please, please go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and give your money while you still have some. This is David Swanson. We will speak with you again next week. Mm-hmm.
one bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of that summer people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.